I'm Al Filreis, and this is Poem Talk at the Writer's House, where I have the pleasure of convening three friends in the world of contemporary poetry and poetics to collaborate on a close but not too close reading of a poem. We'll talk, maybe even disagree a bit, and perhaps open up the verse to a few new possibilities, and we hope gain for a poem that interests us some new readers and listeners. And I say listeners because Poem Talk poems are available in recordings made by the poets themselves as part of our Penn Sound archive, writing.upenn.edu/pennsound. Today, I'm joined here in Philadelphia on the cozy third floor studio of the Kelly Writer's House by Mecca Sullivan, who is published in GLQ, American Visions, Bloom, Crab Orchard Review, and elsewhere, and in addition to her own creative work, is beginning a book-length project on women's writing of the African diaspora. And by Herman Beavers, longtime colleague here at Penn, dear friend of the Writer's House, who teaches a poetry workshop, is a professor of English and Africana studies, and whose poems have been published in Callaloo, Cross Connect, and elsewhere, a Cave Canem activist whose new manuscript of poems is currently making the editorial rounds. And by Alan Loney, the New Zealand-born poet and printer, who currently resides in Australia and has stopped by on a U.S. visit, whose first day at the Writer's House in 2003 produced a fine reading from his book Nowhere to Go, the recordings of which are on Penn Sound, and I highly recommend them. Alan's first book of poems was The Bare Remembrance of 1971, Shards of Silver, among many other books. That was of 2006, investigates the interplay between photography and poetry. Welcome, all three of you. Herm, your first time on Poem Talk, but your 10,000th visit to the Writer's House.
Happy to have made the big time, Al.
And Mecca, thanks for joining us, for walking four blocks west to join us.
It was a great trip. Thank you.
And Alan, a real traveler. You've come half a globe east. So good of you to visit here again, and thanks for coming.
It's absolutely worth the train trip.
Still jet lagged?
No, not at all.
Okay. Welcome. Our poem today is Amiri Baraka's early poem, Kenyatta Listening to Mozart. He was, of course, Leroy Jones then. Readers can find the poem in the book Black Magic of 1969, which collected three early books, but it was first published in a magazine called Matter in 1963. Our recording of Jones' performance of the poem comes from the reading he gave at the Assimilar Negro Writers Conference in Pacific Grove, California, in early August 1964. So here now is Amiri Baraka as Leroy Jones reading his poem, Kenyatta, Listening to Mozart.
It's a poem I wrote for Jomo Kenyatta. It's called Kenyatta, Listening to Mozart. Kenyatta, listening to Mozart, on the back trails, in sunglasses, and warm air blows cocaine from city to river and through the brains of American poets in San Francisco. Separate and lose. Spats brush through undergrowths of fiction. Mathematics bird, undressed and in sympathy with absolute stillness and the neutrality of water. We do not write poems in the rainy season. Light to light, the weighted circumstance prowls like animals in the bush. A zoo of consciousness, cries and prowlings anywhere. Stillness, motion, beings that fly, beings that swim, exchanging in formation. Choice and style avail and are beautiful categories if you go for that.
Does anybody think that the title is meant to be a juxtaposition? Kenyatta and Mozart, is that okay, Mecca?
I think maybe the answer is no for Baraka. I don't know. I mean, I'm thinking about how Mozart appears, you know, elsewhere in Baraka or Jones's work as sort of a representation or a symbol of, you know, a European cultural standard. I'm thinking about specifically in an interview where he says, you know, that basically he's critiquing black nationalists who listen to Mozart. He said that they'll be digging Mozart more than James Brown. And so I think
so that, it's either a critique of Kenyatta or a creation of an irony?
I would say for me a creation of an irony that I think he follows through throughout the poem.
Okay, good. That's a good start. Alan, your thought on that?
Yes, I've actually got a note here that says that about the title, that the incongruous is the norm, that there is something extraordinarily incongruous about this pairing. On the other hand, later in the poem, he's got, beings that fly, beings that swim. He doesn't say beings that walk on the surface, but everything is, flying or swimming or walking, by implication, in formation. And there's that kind of sense of, in that, everything exists, everything is there, no matter how apparently apart and incongruous they seem to be.
We've raised the major issues. Herm, what you were going to say something?
Well, I think it's important to point out that when this poem is written, Kenyatta has just been released from prison a couple
in
years
1961,
before that.
Yep.
And has become part of the government.
And not quite yet, though. I think independence happens in December of 63.
63, right.
And we know that this poem was published in 63, so it was written before that. But Kenyatta was the one negotiating with the British.
Right. And so the irony that Mecca was talking about is also, I think, a way to track what might be Baraka's anxiety about the sort of oncoming post-colonial circumstance.
Why do we have the image of a post-colonial radical, a revolutionary on the trail? This is more Castro than Kenyatta, probably, but on the trail, spats brush through undergrowth of fiction. We have at least half of an image of someone wearing spats. That's a loaded literary and cultural history. Can you say something about that?
Well, that line definitely calls my attention, I think, for the spats, but then also for the brush as, not only a verb, but perhaps as a noun in that stanza.
I'm thinking spats brush.
Well, could be a spats brush. What I'm thinking about is the way in which that stanza seems, a lot of the imagery in that stanza seems to evoke a brush, an animalistic kind of jungle scenario, which I think we, if reading that juxtaposed with the first stanza, we might read that as part of the fiction of Africa, in which case the spats create a sort of tension there between, what might be read as a more, pure or unadulterated Africanness or blackness, mitigated by spats, which I would read as sort of an imposition of Western culture.
Mm, and spats are just the wrong thing to be wearing through the bush.
Well,
just physically.
And Mozart physically. Maybe as yes, well, which yes. is the teaser of the title.
Kenyatta listening to Mozart on the back trails in sunglasses, and warm air blows cocaine from city to river and through the brains of American poets in San Francisco. Separate and lose. Spats brush through undergrowths of fiction. Mathematics bird, undressed and in sympathy with absolute stillness and the neutrality of water.
So we have this problem at the beginning where we have attention paid to one place and one set of politics, and then there's this drifting. The air is always an easy poetic way of drifting from one continent to another, in almost a Ginsbergian way, I would say, to San Francisco, not just America, but San Francisco. Why San Francisco? Has anybody got an idea?
My sense of San Francisco is that there is, throughout the rest of the poem, this image of migratory birds and fish that travel long distances. That's what the mathematics bird is about. The mathematics bird is simply a reference to the fact that birds make calculations about long-term travel that human beings have to have mathematics and technology to actually do.
But what humans...
The question about San Francisco is that my migratory birds and fish go from one specific place to another specific place, and the specificity of place is really important because that's where everybody is.
Well, that's a great background to the human drama of the two aesthetics that this poet is working with, right? I mean, one is a beat aesthetic. I mean, I have to think that in front of the migratory metaphor, of our American poets in San Francisco, people that Amiri Baraka had been hanging out with from 1958 when he co-founded Yugen, and he was involved with Ginsberg and Kerouac and Diane Wachowski, 1961, editing The Floating Bear, and so forth. At the same time, in 1960, he and other African-American writers visit Cuba and become enthralled with Castro, who's really the guy on the back trail, because I don't think Kenyatta actually had to do that. Kenyatta negotiated with the British.
Right.
He was already, you know, when he was in prison, he was in a back village, backcountry village, but he never did that's a Castro image, so that we've got these two things merged. And so if I'm right about suggesting those two worlds, the Beats and the post-colonial revolutionary, how does that help us understand the poem?
Well, I think if this poem were 4 or 5 years later, I would say that what Mecca mentioned earlier about Mozart being the signifier of the sort of Western culture would be in play. I think we have here is Baraka articulating that Jomo Kenyatta is somebody comfortable with the Western world and thereby able to, in ways that are perhaps different from Castro, but able to negotiate with the powers of the West, which is why, you know, I read the sunglasses as sort of the symbol of hip.
He's hip.
Mathematics bird, undressed and in sympathy with absolute stillness and the neutrality of water. We do not write poems in the rainy season. Light to light, the weighted circumstance prowls like animals in the bush. A zoo of consciousness, cries and prowlings anywhere.
When we get to that crucial point in the poem and the form breaks open and we get lots of jagged lines, the poem breaks right there when the subject of a poetic sentence is the weighted circumstance. The weighted circumstance is the subject, and prowls becomes the beginning of a predicate. So it goes, the weighted circumstance prowls like animals in the bush. So what is prowling, and that gets repeated in the next poetic sentence, what's prowling is the weighted circumstance, not Kenyatta and his people, not the San Francisco poets, and not the birds, explicitly none of those, and this is why students of poetry get so mad at us. Because instead of saying, I can tell you who it is that's prowling, he says the weighted circumstance was either a cheat or, you know, a perfect evasion. So if it's an evasion or if it's a stand-in for something else or a way of not defining the subject, which is to say essentially using a pronoun, what is it?
I think that we might look at the weighted circumstance as that which links the phrase before the light to light. And I'm thinking about light as Jomo, meaning Jomo means light, or burning spear.
Yeah.
And then also, you know, thinking about the idea of sort of human connection and particularly connection of a sort of Pan-African connection or a global Black connection, I wonder if we might see light to light as a connection between Baraka and Kenyatta, in as much as Baraka sees himself as sort of, you know, an enlightener of people, a spiritual leader, the Imamu meaning spiritual leader. So in that case, I wonder if the weighted circumstance is the circumstance that the two lights sort of share.
So the problem.
The problem.
The burden. Everybody good with that?
Yeah, I like that.
The burden that prowls like animals. It's still grammatically odd and logically odd, but the burden that we share, I'm going to go with Mecca's reading here, the burden that Kenyatta and the singer, the poet singer, who could be Mozart for late 50s, early 60s America, if you want to stand Baraka in, Leroy Jones in for Mozart, we share the prowling of animals, the zoo, the trap of consciousness.
And
very sad or angry or something.
But I think that word zoo also links up to the beautiful categories toward the end of the poem, because what is a zoo but...
So let's
entity
go
that
there.
That's
let's
built,
go
that's
there.
Built from a number of different categories around species and around, you know, sort of families of animals.
So let's go to the beautiful categories and try to tie in the couple of minutes we have left, back to the separate and lose. I assume separate and lose is partly the problem of categories. If you start separating what these San Francisco poets do from what those with post-colonial desire and consciousness need to do, action and writing and all that, you lose. That's partly what it means.
I think separate and lose may be the closest that Baraka gets to directly referencing the Castro moment, because if you think about it, if you break from, as Castro did, if you break from the United States, you lose.
You're the loser, losing quotes.
And this is 62, 63. The Bay of Pigs has happened.
Sure.
So that there's some pressure that he's trying to put on the line, which is, I think, explains the line break. And I also think that beings that fly, beings that swim, exchanging information, the CIA was deeply involved in the Bay of Pigs and Cuba. Beings that fly, beings that swim, the invasion involved both planes and ships. So I also want to say that the poem is doing some historical work for us.
A zoo of consciousness, cries and prowlings anywhere, stillness, motion, beings that fly, beings that swim, exchanging in formation, choice and style, avail and are beautiful categories if you go for that.
By the time choice and style get mentioned, I think we're well beyond the choice of sunglasses, style of sunglasses. We're into some bigger topic. Can you give us a hint, Alan, about what you think the bigger topic is there?
I think the bigger topic is connection between human beings in the same way that birds are connected. They fly through the sky. They're all individual birds, and yet the whole shaping of them in the sky is the most extraordinary shape-shifting kind of thing. Watch us walk down the street, and we don't do anything like that.
Well, you know,
for the most part.
The way that I read that is it's a commentary on bourgeois culture, which is how I read the beautiful categories. And you'll note that the end of the poem, if you go for that, is Baraka's way of disconnecting himself from the idea of choice and style.
Sure. Just paraphrase, if you go for that.
Yeah, if you go for that.
It means like if you go for that sort of thing.
Right.
With addiction being negative. If you're into that kind of thing, which I'm not.
Which I'm not, okay. Right.
So at the end of the poem, you get that if you go for those kind of categories, but
I don't go for them.
Don't do categories.
Right.
So I think that Alan's right, although he said it's about connections. I would say it's about the wrongness of categories. Now, if that's right, if we've all come to that happy conclusion, there's a lot of agony getting to it because, well, let me just quote Lorenzo Thomas, who wrote about this period of Baraka's career. He's talking about a provocative atmosphere in this time, 58 to 64 or so, a sort of provocative atmosphere of personalized politics that at time was the result of personal problems rather than progressive analysis. That's Lorenzo Thomas saying something that we can't really get into in 20 minutes, but then he asks himself, Thomas does that show up in the poetry of this period? And his answer is, you bet it does. And this poem is one of the examples that Lorenzo Thomas gives as a poem intensively personal, mercilessly introspective, and more self-critical than dictatorial. So self-critical would be, in the most reductive biographical reading, would be, well, I got caught up with these beat cats in 58, 59, 60, and now I'm discovering through Castro the world of the post-colonial. Kenyatta is a better example in a lot of ways than Castro. Now I got to figure out if these are separate categories of interest and what form goes with this new interest. Can I keep both?
Well, we have to pay attention to the we do not write poems in the rainy season.
Can you explain that, which comes in
parentheses.
Well, what does he mean? That's coming off of the
neutrality of water, it is provocative. And I think what I glean from that is, first off, water is anything but neutral, particularly in East Africa. So he's being ironic.
Bitterly ironic.
Bitterly ironic.
We do not write poems in the rainy season.
And so part of what I think I get from that is that we is I think the Beats. And the We Do Not Write Poems in the Rainy Season is about, I think, the way the Beats have abdicated on the kind of political engagement.
Because they can't actually do it.
Right.
Kenyatta's out there, again, in Baraka's semi-fantasy, Kenyatta's out there on the trail in this poem, and poems can't get written. On the other hand, Baraka, Leroy Jones, has given us a poem. He's smelling the cocaine over in San Francisco more than... There's a contradiction here.
Kenyatta listening to Mozart on the back trails in sunglasses, and warm air blows cocaine from city to river and through the brains of American poets in San Francisco. Separate and lose. Spats brush through undergrowths of fiction.
So if the poem is advocating something positively... Instead of, as Lorenzo Thomas is suggesting about this period, agonizing and being self-critical about this middle space that this young poet finds himself in, you know, aesthetically and politically, if it's saying something positive, if it's got a program, or if you were to force a program out of it, what would that be? Herm, I'm putting you on the spot. What's he saying that might be progressive or positive or programmatic?
I think one of the things that he's saying is that... I think from his standpoint at this moment is that it's important for Black folks in the diaspora to participate in Western culture. I think he hasn't abandoned.
So the juxtaposition of the title is not ironic, finally.
Right. Right.
Let Kenyatta listen to Mozart because separate and lose.
Exactly. And I think there is some warning of danger. The cocaine from city to river and through the brains of American poets in San Francisco, it does talk about the potential narcotizing effect.
And the depoliticizing.
And the depoliticizing effect of becoming wrapped up in what is actually affect.
Great. Thank you. Before we get to the Gathering Paradise segment of our show, let me ask each of you to offer a brief final word on this poem and maybe something more on what you get from it. I know we could talk another hour about it. So what other thing would you like to say? Why don't we start with you, Alan?
I'd like to see his poem titled Mozart Listening to Kenyatta.
Thank you. So would I. Mecca?
I guess... You know, I the first thing I think about when I think of Baraka is the notion that poems are a substitute useless unless they are teeth, trees, or lemons piled on a step. And so I wonder how we can look at this poem in terms of materiality. What might we be looking at in this, in looking at this poem? What's piled on the step? What's he leaving us with in this poem?
Great. Herm?
What we haven't talked about, but what I thought about, this poem comes out around the same time as Ornette Coleman's The Shape of Things to Come. And it really reflects the avant-garde jazz that's coming onto the scene. But it's not politicized in the way that the poem that Mecca just mentioned, Black Art. He's in this really betwixt and between stage. Even hearing his voice, he sounds like somebody really a part of the mainstream.
And I guess I would add my own final word is just a footnote, really, for those who aren't aware of this. But Kenyatta was trained in Moscow for a year, but then University College London, and then he studied famously social anthropology under Malinowski at the London School of Economics, and he's written a book of anthropology which I have read, and on the it's written by a Western suited Kenyan who's been trained in Europe intellectually, but the cover, the paperback cover, shows the Kikuyu tribes person, leader, wearing tribal skins and holding the spear that's part of the name, which is saying something double about Kenyatta's constructed leaderly identity. And I think that in some ways, Baraka is wrestling with how one can do the double thing. And Kenyatta, at the moment at least, was doing it very, very successfully, so it's sort of a model for him. We like to end Poem Talk with a minute or two of Gathering Paradise, a chance for several of us to spread wide our narrow hands to gather a little something really poetically good to hail, puff up, commend someone or something going on in the poetry world. So what one thing do you think, Alan?
Straight off, it's Anne Carson's translation of Sappho. It's the most fantastic thing. Buy it now.
Great. Thank you, Alan. That's a good recommendation. Herman Beavers.
My good friend Honoré Jeffers is working on a series of poems on Phyllis Wheatley. I think they're going to really shake up the discussion.
I would like to get a fresh look at Wheatley myself. So that sounds great. Mecca Sullivan.
Well, a good friend of mine who has yet to publish her first book, but who's one of my favorite poets, Camila Aisha Moon, is someone I think to look out for and be excited about.
We will. And if we Google her, we'll probably get some poems published.
Definitely.
Here and there. Okay, great. Well, that's all the Zoo of Consciousness we have time for in Poem Talk today. Poem Talk at the Writer's House is a collaboration of the Center for Programs in Contemporary Writing and the Kelly Writer's House of the University of Pennsylvania and the Poetry Foundation, poetryfoundation.org. Thanks to my guests, Mecca Sullivan, Herman Beavers, and Alan Loney, and to Poem Talk's director and engineer, James Lemaire, and our Rotterdam-based editor, Steve McLaughlin. This is Al Filreis, and I hope you'll join us again soon for another Poem Talk.